one of the co-chairmen, Linda Schwartz, and I'm sorry I'm late. I come from Pawcatuck, and if you don't know where that is, that's as close as you can be to Rhode Island and not be in Rhode Island, about 2.5 miles. So we have quite a large agenda for today, and I'm very glad to see everyone here. And here comes the co-chairman, Mr. Lawler, so we can start with a full compliment. I just want to remind people that we have adopted the decorum of directing any inquiry to our speakers through the chairs. We decided on that the last time, mostly because some of the people were here and really never got to finish their presentation. So should anyone have questions, comments, please direct it to the chair to be recognized. So I'm really feeling like I should stand up for this.
You can raise this up.
I don't think so. Oh, thank you. Well, every little bit helps. Oh, okay. I've had this problem all my life, so. So today we're going to start with the presentations that we talked about, education and training. But before we go into that, does anyone else have any other issues they wish to bring to the chair? All right, then we'll ask Mr. Fisher.
I think Dr.
Foster. Okay. All right. Well, please proceed.
Okay. Thank you. Good afternoon. Thank you for having us again. This is my third time before your group. But I'd also like to introduce my colleagues. We have Arlene Garcia, who is the Director of Safety Education and Training for the Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services, and then Rick Fisher, who is the Director for Staff Development with the department. And as a reminder, I'm the Medical Director for the Whiting Forensic Hospital. So we're going to be here today to talk about education and training, specifically for Whiting Forensic Hospital, Connecticut Valley Hospital, and then taking a slightly broader look to look at department-wide how education and training rolls out. So as you see through the presentation, I'm going to start off by talking specifically about the orientation and training process at the two hospitals, and then I'm going to hand it off to Arlene, who's going to speak about the specifically safety education and training components, and then Rick is going to speak about the larger educational mission for DEMIS. So obviously, please feel free to stop me or interrupt me with questions as recognized by the chair as we go through. So I want to first start off by talking about the training process that happens during staff orientation when we have a new staff member. So for all DEMIS employees, when they become a DEMIS employee, the first thing they do is go through a new employee orientation program. That's a two-day program, and that happens for, as I said, all DEMIS employees. Then once they've completed their two-day orientation to being a DEMIS employee, they go through a direct care staff orientation and training program. That lasts for either 2 or 3 weeks. For our mental health associates and forensic treatment specialists, that's a two-week training program. That is off-site, meaning it's not happening on the care units. It's not within the hospital. It's on the Middletown campus in a separate location, and that's when they're doing a lot of their in-person and computer-based training. And simulation training in anticipation of working on the units. If you look at the third box there that says on-site training, they're then going to come and do on-site shadowing and training on the direct care units where they're going to be working. And I should go back to that second box just to mention the training is 2 weeks long for mental health assistants and forensic treatment specialists. There's an additional week for nurses to prepare them for their work. So 2 weeks for those, the MHAs and FTS staff, 3 weeks for nursing staff, the nurses themselves. When the staff then hit the units and begin shadowing and training and being mentored by another more senior staff member, they're going to do, again, for the mental health assistants and the forensic treatment specialists, they are going to do an additional 10 shifts or 2 weeks of on-site training. That's going to be across multiple units and across multiple shifts to prepare them for the various needs that they might have working on different kinds of units and at different times of day. And again, for the nurses, they're going to have an additional 5 shifts or an additional week of on-site training. That is, so depending on the discipline and background, they're going to have anywhere from 4 weeks to 6 weeks of orientation and training before they ever have a shift where they're actually responsible for a patient and are counted as part of the staff complement. And then once they become part of the DMIS staff, there's ongoing training and development that we'll talk about and how that plays out. So this list here, the activities that are going to happen just in those first, that first box, the first two-day orientation. So there's going to be a human resources component of this to introduce them to being a DMIS employee. So they're going to have a number of reforms they have to complete. They're going to be taught about the policies and procedures for the agency. They're going to be educated about the FMLA process and workers' compensation and various other elements related to their benefits. They're going to have a training in diversity and understanding working in a diverse workforce and working with diverse patients. And then they're going to be educated about the labor relations policies and procedures so they understand the disciplinary process. They're going to meet with representatives from affirmative action so they understand their rights under those doctrine. There's going to be a compliance program where they learn about ethics and the DMIS code of conduct. And they're going to get trained on HIPAA and security training to make sure that all their documentation is HIPAA compliant. They're going to be taught about the electronic health record, which for us is quite sparse at this point. They're going to get a training from workforce development about ergonomics and workplace safety, hazardous communication, and fire safety. We're going to teach them about workplace violence and how to prevent workplace violence. They're going to be taught about the recovery model of care and how to think about consumer affairs and consumer-oriented issues. They'll be taught about multicultural issues, the employee assistance programs for patients who are, or rather for staff members who are struggling with particular issues outside of work, and then they're going to meet with their union representatives. So it's a jam-packed 2 days. When they actually get into the, then once they've completed their required new employee orientation, they're going to have their additional 2 weeks of training. So that's the 9-day training here. So that's going to hit a number of regulatory requirements as well as elements that we think are really important for working with our patients and working within our hospital systems. So they're going to understand infection prevention, infection control. They're going to meet with a panel of patients who are currently living in the hospital. So in Whiting Forensic Hospital, for example, several of our Dutcher patients will go and meet with the staff members during this orientation process. They'll talk to them about what it's like to live in the hospital, what it's like to exist, what it's like to be under the PSRB, and what it's like to work with staff and what makes for really helpful staff members and helpful positive interactions that help them in the recovery process. And then they're going to hear about interactions that are less helpful, and it's going to help staff to understand and be more empathic to the patients themselves and also to have a sense of how to act and how not to act. They're also going to meet with our recovery support specialists. These are individuals with lived experience who are employed by the agency and by the hospital, again, to help the staff members understand what the role is of a recovery support specialist in the patient's recovery plan, but also to understand a little bit further about what it's like to live with, to have lived experience. They're going to get trained in dysphagia, which is difficulty in swallowing, to make sure that they're attuned to choking hazards and risks because it's a hospital setting and people have different medical comorbidities and needs. We're going to talk to them about the patient privilege system, particularly for Whiting and in CVH and the General Psychiatry Division, to understand patients need to have increasing levels of freedom as they become safer and ready to move closer to their community transition. We're going to teach them about elopement. If a patient were to elope from the hospital, what the policies and procedures are around that. We're going to talk to them about patient safety in the community. The goal for all of our patients is to help reintegrate them into the community. So we're going to teach them about how they are to safely transport patients to the community and when they're on community trips with patients, what their responsibilities are with the patients. We will teach them about the patient search process if we have to conduct a search. I know I spent a lot of time here the last time I was here talking about that. We will talk about the admission, transfer, and discharge processes as often patients are moving through different stages of the continuum of care. We will speak about the emergency and involuntary medication procedures and the laws and the DMIS policies around that. We provide them dental education because we do have on-site dentists, both for Whiting and for CVH. We'll teach them about psychotropic medications, the impact of this on our patients. WITS is one of the many electronic programs that we use to capture health data about our patients, so they're taught about that, as is the recovery management system. We'll teach them about restraint and seclusion procedures. So again, this is going to be both the on paper, the policies and procedures we follow when we do restraint and seclusion. And then Dr. Garcia is going to speak about the actual hands-on component of that when she talks about the safety education and training piece. We teach them about routine and special observations, so what their responsibilities are and the expectations are for staff when they're doing sitting with a patient who may be on continuous observation or one-to-one observation. We're going to teach them about trauma, the impact of trauma, and providing care in a trauma-informed manner. We talk about therapeutic communication, what are pro-therapeutic communications and communications that are not helpful in someone's recovery and the proper way to speak to patients. We're going to talk about suicidality and understanding suicide risk and the ways to intervene to try to prevent someone from harming themselves. And then we will also teach them about neuroleptic malignant syndrome, which is one of the most harmful potential impacts of an antipsychotic drug. So outside of that general 2-week to 3-week training, we also have population-specific competencies that are different based on the hospital and the setting within the hospital within which the person's going to be working. So the one I can speak about most knowingly is forensics. So in Whiting Forensic Hospital, we have implemented over the last year and a half a 2-day forensic-specific training for all of our new employees. And I, thanks to Dr. Hauser, I have the training schedule here, and I can talk about the specific components of that. So we're going to talk about issues related specifically to forensics that are different than working in a civil or other non-forensic setting. We teach the staff members about the importance of the team dynamic and the importance of working together as a team, particularly in a forensic setting. We talk to them about the importance of elements of basic mental health and mental illness. So what does it mean to have a serious and persistent mental illness? We talk about different diagnoses, symptomatic criteria, treatments for those illnesses. We talk about trauma and the way that trauma can manifest in other psychiatric ways and how the significance of that, the impact of that, and how understanding the person's history of trauma can have it can help improve our understanding of the behavioral manifestations that we may observe on the unit. We also work with them to think about other elements of verbal de-escalation, setting boundaries, a lot of things that have to do with safety, and it's in some ways it's an extension of the safety education provided by Dr. Garcia. We also talk about other specific forensic issues like problem sexual behaviors. In a forensic setting, we tend to see individuals who have a history of sexual offending more than in other settings, and also a higher degree of people with antisocial personality disorder. And so we teach our staff about the unique characteristics of individuals with such a history and who may be at greater risk of those types of behaviors in our setting and how we manage them effectively. In CVH, they have a number of other specialty areas that they provide site-specific training on based on where people are employed. So they have two different age-specific demographics. So within CVH's campus, they have a young adult services unit, which specifically cares for individuals age 18 to 25 who are dealing with the emergence of serious and persistent mental illness symptoms. They also have a geriatric unit dealing with people who are in the elderly stage of life and dealing with their serious illness. So they provide specific competencies around those. In addition, the Addiction Services Division, which is located in Merritt Hall on the CVH campus, provides rehab and detoxification from illicit substances, and so they're provided specific training around those competency areas. And then, again, within the CVH campus in Woodward Hall, in the same location as the geriatrics unit, we also have a unit specifically designed for the treatment of individuals with acquired and traumatic brain injuries. And so staff who work there receive additional education in those particular areas and what the needs of that population are. So with that, I'm going to pause for a moment and then hand off to Dr. Garcia, who's going to talk more about the safety education and training that we employ throughout the agency.
Dr. Wesser, could I ask you, what is the basic requirement as far as when you're hiring someone for a position? What is your basic requirement?
What educational level?
Yes, and do you have an experiential level as well, or is you're just taking?
So the educational expectation is that staff at least have a high school diploma. Several staff have college degrees or beyond college degrees as well. Experience, there is also an experiential element to it, but advanced education can make up for some of the experiential requirements as well.
Thank you. Nancy? My
question has to do with when this training was put together? I mean, can you tell us if, and maybe we just time it with pre and post the incident that caused, so if there's stuff that was that you were already doing and stuff that has changed since the abuse occurred and was made public, if you could let us know that as you're going through?
Sure. So I can say that some of these things, so for example, the 2 week, 2 to 3 week staff development that happens for all of our staff, regardless of the setting, that whether it's CVH or Whiting, so there are core components of that that have been going on for many years preceding this significant incident that led to the formation of the task force. I think that continues to always morph over time, and I don't know specifically which elements of that have or have not been added. I mean, DMIS has been a recovery-oriented model of care. We've been focused on trauma and suicide, so many of those components have been there preceding this incident. The thing that's been most notable since the incident occurred was this two-day forensic-specific training that's hosted by mostly by our psychologists, so we also have some psychiatrists who are involved in it as well. So that's a new implementation that has happened since the event happened, specifically related to the fact that we felt that our staff would benefit from increased understanding of how to work with our patients and how to safely work with our patients and to be therapeutic in their communications with our patient. As far as the CVH, these sort of age-specific competencies, I believe those have also been in place for some time preceding the incident. I don't think those were implemented as a result of the incident. Any other questions before I pass off?
Paul?
In the ongoing workforce development, how many hours are expected for employees in a calendar year for workforce development, and how frequent?
So if you, you've got quite a hefty packet of materials here. So if you look in the packet of materials, starting on... Trying to find the right page. Is it late? So starting on page 11, there is the mandatory one-time trainings that staff are required to do as part of workforce development. And then if you look further on into the packet, there's a list of annualized trainings that staff are expected to do each year. So the total number of hours, you know, each of those activities can take anywhere from 15 minutes to an hour to complete. I'm trying to find the list here. But just give me a moment. I had this wrong here. So the staff get at least 26 hours annually of mandatory training in a ditch. So that's the bare minimum, is that they're going to do a minimum of 26 hours of mandatory training per year. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
So about 3 days, a little more than 3 days of training is mandatory.
Correct. So that's
over the course of a year.
Correct.
And how often is the list looked at to how often is the list changed, looking at current trends and maybe current issues that are going on within Whiting?
So I would say regularly. So there are a couple elements to that. So there are some required annual trainings that are part of there are DMIS expectations. So, for example, the collaborative safety strategies, which is the de-escalation and physical intervention training. So that is required that we have an annual training on that, as well as CPR for all care providers. I should say, this addresses Nancy, one of your questions before. So an additional training change that's been made since this incident, so really in the past 6 months, is we've expanded the collaborative safety strategies training. So it used to be a six-hour training paired with a two-hour CPR class. We expanded that training to be a full eight-hour day, just focused on safety strategies to give staff more opportunities to simulate de-escalation techniques and talking down patients, as well as the hands-on maneuvers if that becomes required. So things like that are required by DMIS. We have other certain regulatory body requirements for other kinds of annualized training. So there are some things in our annual trainings that just can't change. We have to do them every year. And then there are other things that are being tweaked on a regular basis. So if we feel that staff, you know, could benefit or staff are requesting additional training in a particular kind of. So we had some issues with managing patients with delirium, for example, came up as an issue in Whiting. And so I know we developed a training specifically focused on managing delirium and what are staff expectations, what are the symptoms of delirium, how do you recognize delirium, things like that. So based on the clinical needs of the population, we're changing it on a regular basis. The other piece we've been talking about recently, you know, staff development, we have assigned staff specifically for staff development, but that, you know, education and training needs to be a multidisciplinary effort, and we've learned that and we've seen the benefits of that already from this two-day forensic training we've been getting from the psychology department. And so we've been talking about forming a multidisciplinary education committee for the entire hospital to try to integrate our efforts, because there are other kinds of trainings that are going on. We have professional education around grand rounds and continuing education credits for our professional staff. But I think we recognize that it's an area that we have to have a more integrated effort around, and we're working in that regard.
Right. And so there's a feedback loop built into this where, like, the union can come and say, hey, we really want, like, this type of training, or...
So I would say that, I don't know if you're asking Dr. Hauser specifically.
I'm kind of looking at that, but I'm asking you.
Okay. So I would say that staff have a lot of venues and opportunities to provide feedback about the kind of education they want. We have a safety work group that's facilitated by the Program for Recovering Community Health through Yale. We have an education and training work group facilitated also through the PERCH program. So there's a lot of venues for staff to provide feedback around the kind of education they'd want, as well as our ongoing labor management discussions where that could be another venue. So I think there's a lot of opportunities for them to provide the feedback. I think we do as best we can to be responsive to those requests. Obviously, we can't do every single thing that's asked of us, but I think we try to be both open, receptive, and responsive to their concerns.
Mr. Lawler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Good afternoon, Doctor. Thanks for coming again. A couple of just quick questions. Is there any baseline age that is too young to be employed there? Do you have a cutoff or a minimum or anything along those lines?
I believe anyone who's a legal adult can work in the facility.
And as a practical matter, do you hire people like 18, 19, 20 years old to work at the hospital?
You know, I'd have to get that data from our HR to better. I don't know off the top. I mean, certainly we hire people in their 20s. I couldn't say off the top of my head whether we have 18 or 19-year-olds working in the facility.
And the second question I have is this is the training regime. This is how you onboard people. How frequently does this happen? Does this happen in classes or groups of people all together, or is it like a one-off?
It's a continuous ongoing effort because we're always bringing on new staff. So every 2 weeks we start a new training cycle. So this is happening around the clock. I mean, not around the clock, but in regular two-week increments.
And just to give us a sense of the volume here, about how many people are new hires?
So at any given
year,
So again, I'd have to get the data from HR to say exactly how many new hires we've had, but I would say in the last calendar year, for example. But we regularly, in each of these two-week cycles, I would say we are onboarding anywhere from 8 to 15 new staff members. So I think, you know, extrapolate that out, it's every 2 weeks. That's like, you know, it's over 1 to 200, I would say. But it's hard for me to...
What's the total staffing?
That couldn't quite be right then, because our total staffing is about 540 staff members. Well, that's in Whiting Forensic Hospital. CVH has another, I think, 800 staff members or so that
work. So does this training apply to both or just Whiting?
So we both are doing the same training, essentially, mm-hmm. with some slight modifications based on the needs of the hospital, but we have two different staff development offices there. So the Page Hall is like the location on the CVH campus where this happens. There's two staff. There's a staff development office. But Whiting Forensic Hospital is training its own staff with its own staff development employees, and then CVH is doing a parallel process.
Because if those initial numbers you gave, it seems like a lot of turnover every year. It's like 20, 25% turnover.
Well, which is why I'm wondering if that's quite right. I'd have to get you then. Let me go back to the HR department and get you the actual numbers on it, because I don't want to be misquoting.
I gotcha. Okay. And I'm guessing you may get to this at some point, but as you know, there's been a lot of concerns expressed to us about racial disparities and how people are treated at the or employees et cetera, et cetera. Is that in any way encompassed in the training, like racial sensitivity, implicit bias, sexual harassment? I mean, I know sexual harassment has to be because it's all state employees go through that, but I mean, is there anything other than direct care to patients that's addressed in the training?
So in the new employee orientation program, I talked about those first 2 days, we have training on affirmative action, we have training on working with in a diverse culture with a diverse workforce, and certainly sexual harassment is covered. Mm-hmm. So those sort of basic bread and butter topics are definitely covered from the outset.
And the diversity type training, is that focused only on new employees, or is that an ongoing thing? Because, you know, a lot of the concerns are about sort of as you move up the management ladder, it seems like most of the complaints I hear relate to decisions being made over their heads, which are perceived as racially biased.
Mm-hmm. So I know that in our new employee orientation that is emphasized. Off the top of my head, I don't believe that one of the annual trainings, for example, that's required is necessarily around diversity or the issues you're describing.
Okay. All right. Well, if there's more to that story you'd like to fill in later, please let us know.
Will do.
Thank you.
All right.
Are there any other questions? I have a question. I see the curriculum that you have, and one of the things that is of concern to me is as someone comes to work in this atmosphere, it does take a real special kind of person to deliver this kind of care. And I am wondering, in any of your efforts, your educational training, do you have a component about how the individual can process what's going on and how they can, you know, sometimes resilience, sometimes, and I said I come from a military background, you know, we have this on a regular basis, mm-hmm. to how to deal with the stressors of a high velocity area where there's a lot of things that can happen that are not planned, and how people can actually address that and maintain their own equilibrium. Is that in there anywhere?
So I think we recognize that was a deficit in the training, and so as part of this new 2-day training that we've been putting together specifically for the forensic population, or in the forensic hospital, we have put together as a component of that 2-day training specific education around staff fatigue, compassion fatigue, and self-care. So that has been a big component of it. And I failed to mention, but there's been such a positive response to this new 2-day training that we've implemented for new staff that existing staff members have expressed they'd really like to participate in that. And so the same group that's focused on developing the 2-day training has been developing a streamlined 1-day training that would be for all existing staff members. And so we're just finalizing the curriculum, and we're hoping in the new calendar year 2021 that we're actually going to implement that and come up with a training schedule so all of our staff members can go through the same training.
Okay, well, I'll be looking for that.
Okay.
Mostly because I believe as someone who stays in that atmosphere in your high-charged area, their capacity and ability to be able to provide the best care really depends on their own personal health as well,
mm-hmm.
and that means being able to process what's going on. So
I think we would share.
Yeah. Dr. Hauser?
Yeah, so I just wanted to add to that. I've been involved in the 2-day trainings that are happening and also the 1 days that we're going to roll out to more seasoned staff. And in addition to that, I've also been meeting pretty regularly with Dr. Garcia and her staff around the CSS training with some ideas that I've had about adding some of the content to that. And that is one of the areas that I'm working on, kind of putting together some content to offer to them around that area, mainly from the perspective of, so for decades with regard to police officers, we've learned a lot about like the effects of trauma on police officers, and now a lot of those agencies, just like the military, they do preparation, you know, so like preparing somebody to work, preparing somebody emotionally to work in that type of job. And the staff at Whiting and CBH, you know, would be similar in that respect, that they're first responders to incidents. So I think that's an important component that people need to understand. These are the kinds of things you may see. These are the kinds of things you may feel. This is what to do. This is, you know, this is normal. This is human. This is how you can kind of take care of yourself. So I definitely think that's an important part of it. Two other things that I think are very key aspects, especially with onboarding people, but also like throughout people's careers, has to do with developing a certain mindset in this setting, and that is a mindset that appreciates the need for safety and security, and that safety and security doesn't necessarily mean punitive, right? You can have both, that you can interact in responsive ways to patients while still maintaining a safe and secure environment. It doesn't have to be one or the other, and pendulum doesn't have to be on one side or the other. So how do you sort of carry yourself with that mindset of being attuned to the things in your environment that may be dangerous, while still kind of maintaining that empathic, compassionate approach with patients? And then the third thing is the team aspect. So as Dr. Wasser mentioned, that's a part that is in our two-day training and also will be part of the one-day. But I also want to try to build that more into the annual CSS training so that all these trainings are connected to one another, that they're not sort of in different silos, that there's a continuity to it, that people understand the importance of being cohesive as a team and communicating as a team. That's probably one of the most important factors in, you know, reducing violence and disruption on the unit, is having a strong team. So.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. All right, thank you. So this time I'm going to turn it over to Arlene Garcia.
Dr. Garcia?
You can keep that over there. Yeah. Hi. So my role as the Safety Education and Training Director is to manage the operations of our unit, which delivers safety training to all sites, all DMIS sites across Connecticut, including Whiting Forensic Hospital and Connecticut Valley Hospital. The bulk of the trainings that our department implements really are collaborative safety strategies training, or CSS trainings, and of course CPR, the American Red Cross model certification. But for a full list of the trainings that our department offers, you can see they're in the they were submitted in the, in your packet. I think they start in page 95. But like I said, the bulk of our trainings are the collaborative safety strategies. And this training is a training that upon hire, employees are to take 3 full days of this training, and it's required then annually. And so it's a training that prepares our staff to assess, prevent, and manage behavioral situations. The collaborative safety strategies training aligns with regulatory and accrediting body standards. It also adheres to hospital-specific policies and procedures, restraint and seclusion procedures, as well as routine and special observation procedures. So here we just included a slide that highlights the different modules that are part of the collaborative safety strategies training. You can refer to the handbook, which is in your packet. I think it begins on page 109. So the first module as part of this training highlights the the objectives of the training. People are doing introductions, and there's an overview of what the day will cover. The second module, creating safe and therapeutic relationships in environments of care, look at safety, crisis, the crisis continuum, and it covers patient rights as well. The third module of CSS training reviews risk management. So looking at preventing, assessing, looking at risk factors as well as protective factors among clients and situations. Module 4 then gets into protective physical skills, and these are physical skills that help to keep staff safe as well as clients safe. Module 5 focuses on therapeutic event interventions for enhancing safety and interrupting the cycle. So it really focuses on communication strategies, de-escalation, limit setting, things of that nature. Module 6 looks at safety strategies for escalating and crisis situations. So this is where, as Dr. Wasser mentioned, as well as Dr. Hauser, is where we look at the team approach. It's all a team approach to crisis management. There's a piece on what restraint and seclusion is and what it's not, as well as debriefing. And then towards the end of your handbook, you'll see that there are a few pages that cover physical crisis techniques. So that is the that's a really brief overview of what's included in the 3-day as well as 1-year annual training that's required among DMIS employees that have direct that are direct care staff.
Are there any questions for Dr. Garcia? Dr. Rodas.
So my question actually is going to be similar to Nancy's prior. Of these 7 modules, are any new in the last, since the incident, well, I guess that's the phrase we're using now, since the incident, or is there more emphasis on one than the other than the usual upgrades and updated aspects of it?
So as Dr. Wasser mentioned, for Whiting Forensic Hospital in particular, in meeting with the PERCH safety group, we looked at, they made recommendations, and we looked at ways to enhance the trainings for Whiting staff. And so, as it was mentioned earlier, Whiting staff now get a full day of CSS training. So that's 2 extra hours that they didn't have before. We've been talking in different spaces about the needs of particularly amongst at CVH and Whiting Forensic Hospital, how can we include practice modules that really reflect what actually happens on units so staff can feel as though the training is even more relevant to what they're experiencing. And we've also added a coaching program for Whiting Forensic Hospital. And so the program, the goal is to allow for more opportunity to practice the CSS skills in real case scenarios and discuss CSS interventions that they think would be helpful. And those coaching sessions are run by staff that are sort of informal leaders at the hospital, and we've gone through about 3 of those rounds. So staff on all shifts have the opportunity to engage in those 1-hour coaching sessions.
I would just add, particularly for the coaching program, for both of those elements, actually. So both of these, as Dr. Garcia alluded to, were requests from staff. So staff specifically said we'd like more CSS training and we'd like more of an opportunity to practice the skills. We go, every year we relearn the skills, but we'd really like a chance to practice them. So the additional 2 hours are specifically used for simulation. So it's to actually to give them an opportunity, using adult learning principles, the idea that, sitting in a classroom isn't necessarily just the best way to do it. You need to practice the skills. So staff are actually asked to practice verbal de-escalation, to practice the hands-on techniques. And the CSS coaching program as well was a staff request that we'd like more of an opportunity to have some local expertise to get additional training. And so this group of staff across both Whiting and Dutcher, all 3 shifts, have gotten additional training and certification in being coaches in this program. And the expectation for the coaches is that they will actually provide at least quarterly training on their units for their staff. So it's a significant enhancement post-incident compared to what was being done pre-incident.
Thank you, Dr. Wasser. Thank you, Dr. Garcia.
Could you just refresh our memory? PERCH, what is that?
PERCH is the Program for Recovery and Community Health. So it is a research affiliated program, or is a research program under Yale University that specifically was hired by the Department of Mental Health after this incident to initially do some focus groups about the culture at Whiting Forensic Hospital and CVH, or specifically at Whiting. And then secondarily, they have been part of these ongoing work groups around safety, education, et cetera, to try and enhance and make sure that we have ongoing communication and collaboration between the hospital leadership and the staff.
Okay. Thank you. Any other questions? Paul?
since the abuse, has there been any training on spotting abuse and reporting abuse? How many hours does a new employee get? How is there ongoing training for existing staff? What has changed in that area?
Yeah, so after the incident of abuse, we, first of all, we had significant changes in all of our policies and procedures around abuse, neglect, exploitation. I think I've talked a little bit about that, some of that before when I've been here. As a result of that, all staff were intensively trained around those new policies and procedures, and then that became part of our annualized training. So every year, staff have to be retrained on the abuse and neglect expectations. Also, and again, as everyone knows, there was legislative change also that changed who became mandated reporters, and staff were also educated about their expectations in that regard as well.
Yeah, I was just wondering how that played into, because, you know, when we talk about strong teams, you know, part of a strong team is that everyone's got your back. And so that sometimes doesn't become conducive to, hold it, stop abusing that person. So I'm wondering what parts of the training around that. And I'm particularly interested in that because I saw the interview with the whistleblower on Channel 30, and they talked about a culture where people walk in and say, don't say what you see here. And so I'm just wondering how proactive Whiting is being in that.
So I think that what you're describing are understandable concerns, and there's going to be a tension around, I think we want to build really strong and cohesive teams because I think people working together in collaboration is going to provide our patients the best care possible, and it's going to help staff feel supported in the work they're doing. At the same time, people need to feel safe and comfortable and that there isn't going to be any kind of retribution if they speak out against something that they see that's inappropriate or untoward. So I think in that regard, we have really tried to reinforce with staff the expectation that if they see something, they're expected to say something. And if they're observed, if it's learned or observed that a staff member saw something and did not report it, that they are going to be held sometimes equally accountable for the behavior. And I think as a result of that, all I have is anecdotal evidence at this point, but we have had staff members coming forward expressing concerns about not abusive behavior, but other kinds of behavior that they thought was not appropriate toward their peers or toward patients at times. And I think we're starting to see slowly that staff members are recognizing as much as they want to be part of a team and part of the hospital, they don't want to be penalized because of the action of their peer who they were not necessarily condoning whatever was happening.
Great. Thank you.
And can I just add to that that, from my perspective, strong teams also prevent that kind of stuff from occurring.
Mr. Fisher.
Hello. I'm just going to make some comments about the DEMIS Learning Management System, which is software that we use to actually track compliance with mandated trainings, whether they're instructor-led or whether they're online web-based trainings. So this tracks information on all of our employees, and then compliance reports go out regularly through the software to whoever each facility designates should review these, and then people who are non-compliant with training get called to account. In all of our, I work for the commissioner's office for the whole system of care, including all the private nonprofits. We don't track compliance in the private nonprofits. That's their responsibility. However, we track for all the DEMIS facilities. With the learning management system, staff can self-enroll or they can be enrolled in training, whether it is mandatory training or training that is open to them. Sometimes they may be assigned or recommended to take a training by a supervisor. Sometimes they may take a training. Staff can view their requirements when they log on to the learning management system. They will see a red flag if they are behind. They'll also see what's coming up in the next 30 days. The system also sends an email to them telling them when they're due for a mandatory training, so whether it is mandatory reporting of patient-client abuse, they'll get an email saying that that is coming up. Should they fail to take it on time, they will get an email saying that they are behind on that. The workforce development we focus more on direct care training primarily, and this is open not just to the hospitals but to all of the DMIS facilities and over 200 private nonprofit. So staff can automatically, who are DMIS state employees, get an account set up in the LMS because that's how we track mandatory trainings and other trainings. But staff in the private nonprofit can send in a form. We develop a username and password for them, and they can register for trainings that we provide in catalogs. I gave you the catalog we're working on now, which is the fall. We do a fall, winter, and spring catalog. I gave you last spring's and the one we're working on now. Our winter catalog will come out sometime in mid-December for January, February, and March. And these have both instructor-led trainings. Some of them are 3 hours. Some of them are 5 or 6 hours. And some of them are multiple days, like 2 Tuesdays in a row, for instance. These are free to all staff that work in our system of care. We also have online web-based trainings, which I also gave you the list of those trainings, on topics. Almost all of the trainings have continuing education units for the licensed people that need continuing education units. Social workers need 15 hours a year. Addiction counselors need 20 hours. Licensed professional counselors need 15 hours. Marriage and family therapists need 15 hours. Licensed clinical psychologists need 10 hours. And so they're able to get these for free. With the web-based training, we also, because we have a workforce problem in addiction counselors aging out and retiring at a faster rate than new ones are coming in, we try to provide all the trainings that would help to certify people as an addiction counselor. There's certification and licensure. Licensure, you have to have a master's degree. Certification, you don't, but you have to have hundreds of hours of training. And so we try to provide the training so that people in the addiction world can eventually get certified as a certified addiction professional. So we try to make all of our trainings relevant as co-occurring disorders for people who have a substance use disorder, a substance use disorder, and a mental health condition. We try to make them more geared towards direct care. We also try to fill in all the requirements so that when people take the exam for a certified or licensed addiction counselor, they will have all the information they need to be able to pass the test. We also work with the Connecticut Certification Board to provide free workshops on how to become a certified professional. What is good about the online trainings is it's very difficult for inpatient at Whiting and at CVH to let a person leave for a full day because of coverage issues. With the online training, they bookmark, so if somebody starts it and is called for a crisis or is called away, they can close that account. They can close that training. When they log on again, they can resume where they took off. So if it's an hour training, they could do it in 15-minute intervals. If it's a two-hour training, they could also do it in 15-minute intervals or half-hour intervals and still both get their continuing education units, but more importantly, learn some things that will help them in their care of the people that that we serve, I think. And then the final slide is just in our whole system of care. And so all of our facilities, Whiting, CBH, our community mental health centers, all offer both instructor-led and web-based trainings. And so combined for everyone, and this would include Dr. Garcia's trainings, the trainings that my division provides and that the facilities provide, there were 1,844 instructor-led trainings with 21,654 completions. In web-based training, we have 327 with 59,384 completions. Questions?
Does anyone have any questions? I think I'd like to address this to all three of the educational folks. How do you identify gaps in the kind in training needs for your employees versus what's actually happening in the clinical areas? Do you do an assessment? How do you do that?
Well, it's several ways. Some of the things we do are to meet federal block grant requirements in terms of implementing evidence-based practices. Evidence-based practices, some of you may know, are practices that research show actually work with particular disorders. The other thing that we do, the second thing that we do, is we meet with the training managers from our DEMIS facilities at regular intervals, and they bring to us what the requests are, and then when we hear that this is a request that is needed, we do our best to provide training on that. The other thing we do is in every training, we have an evaluation of that training with comments where we ask people to make suggestions for training. So sometimes the needs in the private nonprofit world are a bit different than in the state operated world. And we try to really provide requests, especially when we're hearing the same thing several times. Some of our facilities do training need surveys, and then the training managers bring those to us. So often some of the trainings that we've done are really come from things that were being requested, and we try to either, if our staff can provide that training, or we use people from the outside, either within DEMIS or people that we pay to provide training.
Well, let me ask a follow-up question. Were you going to say something, Dr. Wester?
I was going to answer the question for the hospital, but if you want to ask a follow-up question, I can wait.
Well, we've been talking about teams. We've been talking about stress. I am wondering how much of an investment do you make in helping your staff to be able to grow within the needs that are being presented by your patients? That's what I'm after.
One of the things that we offer is what we call clinical supervision, but it's really not necessarily clinical. We train supervisors to be able to sit with staff members to improve their skills and how to assess what skills they have and what skills they lack in different areas. And so what we're trying to do is build a direct supervision so that more supervisory folks can meet with more junior folks and help them improve their client direct
when
skills.
You're talking about supervision, are you talking about it from the
We're not talking about it.
We're talking about clinical.
Nothing about attendance, nothing about rebellious employees in these particular trainings. These trainings are focused on how to improve the employees' direct care skills.
So you're talking about it from the clinical point
yes.
of view.
Yeah,
rather
more
than
so, yeah. When we say we think of clinical as to some extent to what our licensed people do.
No,
and
I read you,
really
but I want to be sure everybody
manager.
Else here knows what
yeah.
You're talking yeah. about. It's not a pejorative thing.
So from the hospital perspective, you know, I've talked a fair amount about this, the new forensic-specific orientation we put in place. So we didn't just do that. I mean, we didn't just come up, sit around a room and come up with our own ideas about what we thought would be helpful. The first thing we did was we put out a survey to all of our staff, and we said, what are the areas that you would like to learn the most about? and we got a number of responses. Obviously, it's not fully representative of the 500-plus people in the hospital, but we got a good representation of staff across disciplines and shifts and different things, and we use that to inform the new orientation that I've been talking about. So I think we regularly try to inquire from our staff, and I think we have inquired with our staff what they want their needs to be, and they think they need more education around, and I think part of our ongoing educational plan is to do a better job of regularly surveying our staff to understand what they think their educational needs are, and then to base our educational initiatives around what they think what we think would be helpful, but also what they are saying they need.
So let me also ask you this. Do you ever use some of the issues that are arising in the clinical areas that are confrontational for the staff? Do you look at where you're having problems with staff to drive some of the creation of your training? What I'm trying to get at is, if you look back at the incident that brought us all together, in retrospect, was there anything you could have done with training by looking at what was going on over not just one patient, but it seems like a long period of time.
So it's very hard for me to say what could have been done preceding the event. I wasn't a part of the hospital preceding the event. I can say since the event, we certainly incorporate trends that we're observing in the clinical milieu of the units to inform how we provide training and education to the staff. So just in the past calendar year, our staff development office has put together two additional trainings on identifying risk or identifying imminent risk, and on verbal de-escalation in particular. Those were trainings that were computerized trainings, but they involved a lot of video clips of different interactions that one might observe, and the people who were involved in those were actually our staff members. So we got some of our most senior staff members to help simulate events that happen in real time on the units that they recognize are concerns for our staff. And I think particularly in the aftermath of the events that happened, staff had some there was a lack of clarity about what is imminent risk. What are the situations, for example, that justify or require someone to put hands on another person to make sure that there's a safe interaction, and what doesn't necessarily require that? And so we understood and we heard loud and clear from staff that they were struggling with that issue, so we specifically developed some training materials to help people better understand that. You know, also in our governing body through our quality, risk, and safety committee, we are regularly looking at trends and incidents, whether it's, you know, number of falls that we're having or whatever. And based on those, we're developing corrective action plans that often involve training of staff, whether it's medical staff, direct care staff, whomever, to make sure that the trends that we're identifying as being significant issues for the hospital are being addressed through an educational form as well as other corrective actions.
Nancy?
I'd like to change the narrative a little bit here. Instead of talking about staff needs, I'd like to turn it around and talk about patient needs and patient requests, because there's been a lot of discussion about what the staff is asking for, what the staff wants. I'd like to know what you have in place, if in fact anything, so that you can find out what do the patients want, what do the patients think that the staff needs. I know that we're going to be visiting the steering committee. Is there a mechanism in place so that you can get regular feedback from members of the steering committee as to what they think staff needs? Do you use incidents and not look only at what happens from the staff perspective, but what's happening from the patient perspective, the resident perspective, as to what was missing, what the staff did wrong, why they need training in X, Y, and Z. So I'd, you know, completely like to switch this and find out what you're doing from the patient perspective.
Yeah, so of course we're going to value deeply the input of our patients and what they think would help them live more safe, productive, happy lives in the environment that they're living in for as long as they're with us. So there's a number of opportunities for staff, for patients to express those. So it's at a number of levels. So one, obviously, any patient who has any individualized based concern about a particular staff member, a particular interaction they had, they're going to have multiple opportunities through the patient advocates who are employed by the hospital to express that concern, and that's going to be filtered up to the director of advocacy, ultimately our director of quality and compliance, and the hospital leadership to identify whether there are specific needs for an individual or group of individuals. The second is, in both buildings, we have a weekly patient steering committee that you've identified. So that's going to be an opportunity for patients of both facilities to express their concerns. And the patients do regularly express what they think are some of the concerns, and at times have shared with us what they think would be helpful to them from a staff learning perspective. And a lot of times we try to be responsive to those. We can't always be, or we don't always necessarily agree, but whenever we can and we think that there's merit to what they're saying, we're going to be responsive to that. The final opportunity is every year, for the entire department, every facility conducts a patient satisfaction survey in which patients are interviewed to understand their satisfaction with the services they're providing across a number of domains, and we use that to also inform what we think are going to be the educational and training needs for our staff members.
And would you get back to the patients to let them know if their suggestions or recommendations or requests are in fact going to be implemented, so that they feel that there is actually some merit and value in their taking the opportunity to make these requests?
So it's going to depend on the nature of the request. So if a patient expresses a concern about an individual staff member, in most instances, we're not going to go back to the patient and give them feedback about what did or did not happen with that individual staff member, because that's going to be deemed as part of their confidential HR operations, and if they needed to get education or supervision in a specific area. If it's something that is expressed openly in a public forum, the patient says, you know, I think the staff could benefit from X, Y, or Z kind of training, and we incorporate that, we're certainly going to feed back to the patients that, you know, in fact, we heard you loud and clear, and we've done that before, and patients have expressed that we think the staff could benefit from more training around blank, and we've implemented and then come back to the patients to tell them. The final piece I'd say is around the patient satisfaction survey. That's an anonymous survey, and so we couldn't possibly use that as a means to go back to the patients and give them that feedback.
And I guess the final question I have is, do you ever use the patients as trainers?
So
if you're doing role plays or just in any capacity, use the patients.
So I think, as I talked about, during the 2 weeks of orientation that all of our staff members go through, we have patients regularly meeting with our staff members to talk to them about their lived experience, about what it's like to live on the units, to live in the hospital, both in Whiting and in Dutcher. And so we are involving our patients in the educational experience. I don't think we would ever use a patient in a simulation experience where it had to do with de-escalation or something like that, because I think I would be worried that might be traumatizing for a patient or re-traumatizing for them. And certainly even if it were accidental, if somehow the patient got hurt in the process, that could really be a serious event for us. So I think we try to utilize them in a recovery-oriented way to help them understand when I say lived experience, I don't just mean the typical way of a lived experience, but literally what it is like to live in this hospital for days, weeks, months, years, and how staff have positively or not positively impacted that experience.
So one of the things that I remember from some of our earlier packets, especially pertaining to CVH, were a couple of DPH reports on breakdowns on special observations where a person was assigned a 1-to-1 or a 2-to-1 and they injured themselves in those reports. And there was a lot of talk about retraining that person. Have we ever looked at the actual training to see, are people testing out of that training, or is it just we gave you this training and there you go? And the other question I have for Dr. Wasser, is this the DEMIS standard satisfaction survey that you're talking about?
Yes.
Okay, that's...
Let me rephrase. What do you when you say the standard? So I've worked in other DEMIS facilities and I've seen the same patients.
Yeah, so that would be the DEMIS standard satisfaction survey.
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
The in response to the question around special observation, so I guess I'm not sure I understand the question. Could you rephrase it? I mean, I understand the piece that people have had to be retrained, but I'm not sure I understand the second component of it.
The second component is, do people have to test out of that training before they're put on special observation to actually do the job? Because it seems like, just from the explanations that I've seen Demas put forth, that, you know, you have to be able to see their face, their neck, and their hands at all times, and I'm wondering where the confusion is on that with that training. And so I'm wondering if it's something systemic within the initial training that people aren't catching it, or it's not being understood, because there seem to be at least two or three incidents in that report.
So it's hard for me to know specifically without knowing the specifics of the incidents, but what I would say is the regular part of the special observation training is there's two elements to it. So there's the policy and procedure element of it. They have to know what it says on paper in terms of what the expectations are for a staff member. And then there's the in-person training. So that's going to happen during their initial 2 weeks of shadowing, that they're going to be on a unit where there's going to be at some point a special observation. They're going to be paired up with a staff member, and they're going to be taught how in person, in vivo, to do the on-site training or the on-site special observation as part of their training. There isn't like a testing, like there's no test at the end of that training experience to say, did they meet a competency in that regard or not, other than if the senior staff member they're working with or the nurse on their unit felt that the particular staff member wasn't competent, had not demonstrated the ability to follow the procedure, their training can be extended until they demonstrate that capacity. So I would say as a matter of routine, there's not like a CO test at the end, but if anyone had any concerns that someone was not following the policy, then they could extend their training as a result of that until they demonstrated the competency.
I think you raise a question in my mind as to within the training program that you have, do you have stated and levels of competency in which individual employees are rated?
It depends on the level of staff member you're talking about. So for nurses, yes, specifically for nurses in terms of the various kinds of medical and nursing procedures they have to do on a unit, they do have to have a demonstrated competency in that regard. And similarly, if you look at the extensive there's an on-site training checklist. I think it's called the DBO. It's in the packet that I handed out for both our mental health assistants and our forensic treatment specialists. There's a number of areas that they have to have been observed to participate or to demonstrate that ability and then be checked off as having been competent in that. But it's not as if there are rating levels that you're, you know, it's a 1 to 5 or something. It's either yes or no.
I'm wondering about the people that have the most interactions with your patients.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a level of competency that you judge, or they, you know, Paul brought out a very good point. I mean, you can check off a box, but that doesn't mean you can actually perform the issue.
So I guess what I'm trying to say is the staff, during their 2 weeks of training, they're assessed on all these various things by either a senior staff member or a nurse, depending on what the competency is, to make sure that they're capable of doing it before they're allowed to be a part of the staff and complement.
Is that done periodically or just on when they first come to work?
So it's done on their initial orientation to the unit, and then really would be if other issues arise. I mean, if some question comes up about their competency, then it's going to be assessed at that time. But no, it's not going to be routinely checked on an annual basis or something like that.
So how would you identify someone who was having an employee, a hands-on employee, if someone was having an issue, a difficulty with their job, doing their job? How would you identify that?
So we have many layers of supervision that are built in throughout the system to identify people who are having issues. So whether it's a mental health assistant or a forensic treatment specialist, whether you're working in Whiting or Dutcher or CVH, every unit has a lead person that's identified for that unit. So there's a lead mental health worker or a lead forensic treatment specialist whose job it is to oversee the work of all the other people working under them. So that would be one, the first layer of supervision. The second would be all of those individuals work under the care of the nurse, the head nurse on the unit. So it would be for them to identify if someone's having an issue and they're struggling in some regard. Under all of them are the nurse supervisors who would then have an opportunity to round on all of their units, and if there were concerns expressed about someone's competency, it would be up to them to address that with the individual through whatever the appropriate means are. Under the nursing supervisors are directors of nursing who are managers who would then would be responsible for any kind of HR or disciplinary thing that might come out. So we have many, many layers of supervision and observation who are going to catch if there are concerns about a particular staff member's behavior or capability, and we are frequently providing education and supervision. I guess the last I'd say is our directors of nursing or our managers on duty are using the video camera system that we have to do random spot checks throughout the hospital every single shift, three times a day, every day. And so if during that we were to observe some behavior that was concerning, whether it's just that someone needs training or there was really something improper about what the care they were providing, that'd be another opportunity.
I have one more question. So let me ask you this. With the incident and the it wasn't just one incident. It was a terrible thing that happened. So that it was over time. Yes?
Excuse me. This was ongoing abuse.
Yes.
By a team of people. It wasn't an unfortunate incident. It was systemic abuse. And we've reduced it to this incident thing, like it was a one-time thing. This went on for many years, and it involved many people, 10 of who were convicted. And it's offensive to just call it the incident now.
A much better job of capturing what I was trying to say. I'm trying to be diplomatic, but thank you. Thank you very much. Because that's why we're here. It wasn't one day, but how do you account for the fact that did you just put in some new ways of doing things? Or how did that happen over time that repeatedly these infractions were going on and your supervisors and everybody was just, it didn't seem to be addressed adequately?
So I guess I want to be mindful of a couple of things. So I don't want to in any way diminish the significance of the impact of this. So it was obviously abuse. People have been convicted of criminal acts as a result of this. But to say that it happened over years is the evidence that we have is that there were 30 days of video capturing several incidents happening over that period of time. So I just want
to... And to say that it wasn't happening because it wasn't videotaped because the cameras weren't working is a little naive too. Like all of a sudden the cameras came and this started. We know that's not the case.
I'm not trying to insinuate that it wasn't happening. All I can say is I don't have that evidence. So if you want to make that assertion, that's your choice. But I have to work with what people, the evidence that's available to identify what occurred that I know visually happened, that people were convicted of, that people were fired over. That's all I can speak to. So, and for me to say what happened, why wasn't that identified, why were there these breakdowns in communication, observation, supervision, there's no way for me to answer that. I can't possibly know why that happened or how that happened. Obviously, there were many people who were involved in it, many people who were aware of it, who were disciplined, fired, faced criminal charges. How those things happened and how there was the breakdown, I can't speak to that. I just don't know. All I can talk about is what we've done since to try to make sure that nothing like that ever happens again, and the increased layers of supervision and the expectations of supervisors, the expectations of all the staff members there, the video monitoring that's been enhanced, the managerial presence that's been enhanced, the expectations for all staff members to try to capture anything untoward, and the way that we respond and the expectations we set on our staff in terms of reporting anything they see, and when we know of anything, the way we respond to it. So that's all I can say, I guess, and I feel like we're getting a little adrift from the educational component of it, though I recognize it's related.
Well, may I?
Certainly, go ahead.
I mean, I find this hard to wrap my brain around, because if you can sit there, and I don't mean to make this personal, And say, well, we don't know what happened or how it happened, but we're doing all this great stuff, so it won't happen again. You can't prevent it. It's impossible to prevent if you don't really understand where the system broke down. And yes, I know you have video surveillance now that was not available, and I totally agree with Paul that if something isn't captured on video, doesn't mean it didn't happen. That's naive at best, I think. So what is different, aside from the videos, and that some people were fired, what is different now that can prevent this from happening again? What is different about this lauded supervision and the multiple layers? If they didn't catch that, why should we be sanguine enough to believe that it's not catching stuff that's going on now?
So I'm pausing to answer because I'm trying to be really thoughtful here, and I think, again, I want to be clear. I'm not trying to be naive or coy. I'm only trying to speak to what I can speak to. So there's no way to ensure 100% that nothing like that could ever happen again. We are going to do everything we possibly can. And I think we've come here before, and when Hal Smith and I came the first time, we talked about, and I feel a little at a loss, because we spent a lot of time talking about all the changes we've tried to put into place in terms of increasing the managerial presence on site 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that was not previously present. We've talked about increasing the on-site presence of these various layers of supervision and management. We've talked about the enhanced camera security. We've talked about having the nurse managers, the directors of nursing, or other managers on duty checking those cameras every shift, every day, across the entire hospital, which wasn't happening before. We've talked about the security service that's an outside agency that's been hired by DEMIS to monitor the cameras 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, throughout the entire hospital. We've talked about the additional training that we've given to staff about their expectations to be mandated reporters if they observe any abuse or neglect. We've seen evidence of that happening. We have talked about, and from a clinical perspective, we have been much more thoughtful about the ways in which we put people on constant observation, the ways in which we de-escalate patients, the justification for putting hands on patients, the review. Every single incident where a staff member's touch a patient is now reviewed by a manager, and if there's any concerns about that, it comes to my level or the CEO to review if there was any untoward incident or any untoward behavior in the context of that incident. So, you know, to me, there are so many things we're doing that were none of those things, or those things were not being either done or attended to with the same level of efficiency, proficiency, and attention if they were being done at all before. So I think, to me, we are certainly doing our very best to address in every way we can imagine how to educate people better, how to train people better, and how to observe what's going on as best we can. And whenever there is an event where there is an increased chance that something might happen, we are reviewing that closely to make sure that everyone was doing whatever was they possibly could to make sure it was a safe environment and nothing beyond that. So I think that's all I can say in terms of trying to address what we're doing differently from before.
Okay, Dr. Votis.
So, Dr. Wasser, I just want to pick up my colleagues. I think things happen in healthcare all the time, right? And sometimes an adverse outcome happens that may have happened many times, and it comes to your attention, and you can fix it through process, procedure, training, and all of that. When it's a little more systemic and ongoing for a longer period of time, it becomes a little more of a cultural change because, for whatever reason, the environment allowed it to happen and be ongoing. Whether it's 30 days, 60 days, 90 days, or years is arguable. Our goal here is to move forward, right, mm-hmm. Figure out. So the question I have in my mind is, do you feel as though with all of what you've just said, actually, which was actually very articulate, everything from the hiring practices, the onboarding, the training, the ongoing surveillance, do you feel as though the culture has changed that has mitigated, to the best of our abilities, the best of your abilities, have we mitigated the likelihood of something like this pattern of behavior, we'll call it, is largely mitigated?
So I believe that we are starting to change that culture, and I agree that I think it has to come with culture change. I think there are a lot of very good staff members who come to work every day at our hospital, and they were there before, and they continue to be there, who come in to try to care for patients and provide them the best care possible. And I think we need to continue to find ways to acknowledge them and to bring them forward and bring their good ideas forward. I think we are continuing to try to find ways to do that through various programs we're in starting out with. I think we are also trying to slowly shift the culture away from what Paul was describing before about, we want people to have each other's back, but we also want people to come forward if they see things that are inappropriate. I think we've really been trying to shift the culture in that regard, and we're starting to slowly see evidence that that's happening. I think we are trying to be responsive to their educational requests, and I think by some of the trainings I've described today, we've begun that process. I think we recognize we're not all the way there, and we still have work to do. We've also been exploring other models. So we've been looking outside of our state, outside of our country even, to understand what are different models of care, education, milieu management models, as they're often called, that are employed in other hospitals, to see, could we learn something from those? Could we bring something from those models back to our hospital and use that as a way of shifting both the educational focus, creating a different common language amongst our staff, and moving the culture in a more positive direction? So we haven't decided how to move forward in that regard, but we're in that exploratory process, because I think, I'm trying to wear two hats here at the same time. I'm trying to say a bad thing, a really terrible thing happened, and we're trying to move forward. And we're doing the best we can, and we're thinking of a lot of interesting, creative ways, and I think we've made strides. But I'm also saying we have a ways to go, and we need to keep working, and we recognize that. And so we're certainly open to input about how best to do that, but that is an ongoing, iterative process for us. I'm not here to say we're done. I'm here to say we're still working on it.
Dr. Hauser.
So, I just wanted to add a piece to this to say that, I agree, Paul, that I think to say that these events, started on February 22nd and nothing existed before that is probably naive. At the same time, I don't think it was ongoing from day one. So at some point during those two time periods, something happened and something evolved over time. And there, I think, are so many factors that play a role there that we may never be able to reduce it to, one single cause or event or something like that. I think it's something that evolved over time. At the same time, I will say that when the investigation began, all the cameras for all 30 days on all the units were reviewed and nothing else was found. This is not to say that that unit is a bad unit and everybody on it was bad people, but I'm saying something happened and something evolved over time for a number of reasons that everybody had their eyes shut to. And this event fundamentally changed Whiting and working in Whiting, and I think a lot of people have their eyes open now, and that might be one thing that's different. The event itself is the one thing that's different that wasn't in place before, that nobody ever thought that something like that could happen, was happening, would ever happen, and when it did, everybody became cognizant of that. So all those layers of supervision that are in place with a different mindset, I think.
I would just like to say one thing. We are here because the people of Connecticut are very disturbed about this happening, and we want to be sure it doesn't happen again. But if you are doing training or education and you have no way of determining whether that is actually working, you're going to have to look at quality assurance, and it's going to have to be something to do with the hands-on. It has to be at the level where your patients are. And I asked this before, and I ask it again. Is this a hospital? Do you expect these individuals to get better? Or is this just another prison?
So by the name, yes, it's a hospital. I think the state already decided that when they said, we'll call this Whiting Forensic Hospital. And, yes, the expectation is that people will get better there. And it needs to be that expectation. As soon as we get to the point of these people will never leave, then we've dehumanized them. We've taken away their chance for growth. We've taken so much from them that they just become objects of the state. So I think that we do have to have the expectation. And I think Lori's expressed before that she expects everybody there to get better at some point.
Yeah, so I'd really like to echo. So having spent time in prisons and correctional facilities and now having spent the last 2.5 years working at Whiting, I mean, we are clearly a hospital. Our focus is on the recovery of our patients. It is not housing them indefinitely. It is not keeping them forever. They all come in under different legal statuses for different purposes. They stay with us for different durations of time based on whatever the judicial authority is that's over them that influences that process alongside us. But we are certainly trying to enhance people's recovery. And the goal for every person who comes to Whiting is for them to leave Whiting and when they're ready to do so and when we can help them do that. And I know you're going to have some guests, other guests talking about other things. But, you know, we have certainly been trying to, Paul, to your point, we are trying to safely enhance the speed at which people get to leave our doors. And I think if you talk to the PSRB or others, you'll find that that's been the case over the last couple of years, that's been a big focus of ours, is trying to safely enhance people's recovery and get them back to the community. So that is unquestionably our purpose.
I think it's our purpose, too. I think that we are here to synthesize all that you're talking to us about and to help you in that mission. And I see you as a vital part of, as we are going forward, we need to hear from you what it is that you need from the state of Connecticut, from this General Assembly. And so I think we've got, I think we have a better playing field than we did when we started today. So we know we're not talking about one incident. We're talking about a culture.
I would say we are welcome to all the help we can get. As I said, our mission is to care for the patients as best we can, to enhance the hospital as best we can, and any ideas that people have for how we could do that better, we're open to.
Okay, Nancy.
I would like to propose, and I know that you guys probably have not finished, and I know there was a question about so many questions you can't get finished, but it is 1:37. We do have two people we haven't heard from and the topics have now become related, because there was a statement made about how people are being released from the PSRB much more quickly now. And maybe that's a good segue, if people agree, to move. Because I don't want our friends to sit there. I mean, they were invited to this meeting and to not have an adequate opportunity to do what they came for. And at the very least, I'd like to ask my friend Monty Radler, is it true that people are being released more quickly? And maybe
let's wrap up. Let's just check. This meeting is to go to 3 p.m. Okay, so we're like halfway. But is there any more questions or comments about the educational presentation that we've heard today? Yes, Dr.
I just wanted a point of information. So Attorney Lawler had asked me earlier for some information about the number of new hires that we have coming through. So while we've been here, I've been able to get that data. So for Whiting, we had 90 new hires in the last fiscal year, and for CVH, they had just under 200. So that's the total number of people going through staff development in a year. No problem.
Is there any other comments? Okay, well, I'd like to thank you all for coming and for making this presentation and for helping us with our dialogue.
Thank you.
Thanks. My co-chair indicated I could take it from here, so... I just want to welcome Monty and Kevin. We've worked together for many years, Monty in the public defender's office, Kevin in the prosecutor's office. And I, I,
I don't know how much you've been informed about what our goals are in this task force. I assume you've read the statute. You basically know what the goal is here. And we've been given specific charges, only one of which I think is really directly relevant to your expertise, which is the PSRB, right? And so I think, speaking for my colleagues here, I think we'd be interested in your perspective on how it works, whether there should be modifications made, and especially as it relates to who is ending up at Whiting and for how long, obviously. And I just want to throw in one thing that's not specifically mentioned in the charge we received from the General Assembly, but it has emerged as we've talked about these topics over the last few meetings, and that is, in addition to those who are not guilty by reason of insanity and are patients at Whiting, there are a fair number of people who are being held on competency to stand trial basis, right? And as I understand it, when Dutcher is filled, some of those patients are in essence, spill over into Whiting. And it does seem like, aside from the PSRB, which is the back end of this system, that maybe the front end should be examined with the same viewpoint. Is the decision that is landing people at Whiting Hospital for a competency evaluation, competency restoration, can that be more fine-tuned, right? And because I think it's fair to say that a fair number of the problems that have to do with how the patients are treated and the concerns the staff has, et cetera, have a lot to do with they're full all the time. And maybe if there are methods to address either the back end or the front end and still ensuring public safety and appropriate adjudication of these cases, we'd like to hear about those as well. So why don't you begin, Monty, and then I'll turn over. Make sure your microphone's on over there. Press that button.
Thank you. I kind of wish I heard the first part of all this presentation before, you know, preparing what I had to say, because a lot of it dovetails with what I have to say. But in any event, I'll do my best to.
Let me just say, saying the same thing twice from two different perspectives is important for us to hear. And if, to the extent you disagree with anything they put out,
oddly enough, I don't disagree with anything that I've heard, both in terms of the information presented and also the pointed questions that were unable to be answered. Because, you know, it boils down to a culture issue, which everybody acknowledges, and I'm not sure anybody fully understands how that culture developed and what factors influence that culture to continue to exist and how to get rid of it.
Mate, I don't mean to interrupt, but we're on CTN today, are we, or not? Oh, we're not. Okay, I was going to say, because we know your background, but if we were on CTN, I would ask you to explain a little bit about your background.
Oh, okay, okay. I was just thinking of doing that, so let me do that. I've been a public defender for 37 years. The first 13 years, I was a Part A serious felony trial court public defender. The last 20 years, I've been head of the psychiatric defense unit, and my clientele are insanity acquittees who are committed under the jurisdiction of the Psychiatric Security Review Board. My job in connection with them is to assure that they get due process, but also to advocate for whatever they need to get through the levels of the PSRB system from entry to unconditional discharge, which takes many, many years. An essential part of that is to participate in their everyday treatment. I'm exposed to what goes on by either myself or my staff attending treatment team meetings, so I'm intimately familiar with the issues that they have. Also, I've been attorney for the same people for many, many years, and I've had, you know, obviously the opportunity to follow them longitudinally. Also in the public defender system, I have been the public defender member on the behavioral health subcommittee of CJPAC and have been involved in, from the public defender perspective, on most legislation that has gone through over the last two decades in mental health reform within the criminal justice system, diversion, that type of thing, and the kind of treatment that goes on both in DOC facilities as well as in the civil system. I've also had experience litigating serious civil commitment cases, so I am familiar with the civil commitment process, the civil commitment standards, and in the course of litigating criminal commitment issues over 20 years, basically the same issue, and that is whether an acquittee can be held on forever, I spent at least between a year and 2 years doing an intensive investigation of my own on how Connecticut Valley Hospital works, both the civil side and the forensic side, not only legally, but in terms of the treatment modalities that are used, the standards that apply, and the differences between those two systems. By way of educational background, I also came into the public defender business with a master's in counseling. I've had, I can't tell you how many hours, perhaps years of continuing education in the area of mental health and mental health treatment. I think probably the best compliment that was ever given to me was by former psychiatrist on the Psychiatric Security Review Board, Justin Schechter, at his retirement celebration when he said, you know as much as most first-year interns when it comes to mental illness and mental illness treatment. So I really appreciated that. In addition, in terms of practical experience, I've always kept open channels of communication with Connecticut Valley Hospital administration on all levels. Most people were very happy to do that. Some saw me as the enemy because I'm a public defender and I'm representing, people who are, some would say, incarcerated there. And I also have maintained open channels and cooperative relationship over the years with the PSRB, including Ms. LaChance and her predecessor, Martha Lewis. So the bottom line is I have a lot of practical experience, and hopefully I can contribute to this discussion. I think, as a general overview, as I understand it, the key things that have happened over the years leading up to the creation of this task force, basically the first significant event, as I recollect, was the 2007 DOJ investigation, which cited CVH for violations of the Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act. And then there were a number of recommendations that came out of that report, some of which were followed up on and implemented, and some of them not. And then the other significant things were three things which basically, I've sort of lost track, but they're sort of contemporaneous. The Shahadi abuse scandal and the subsequent fallouts from that, the civil lawsuit, the criminal prosecutions, the legal reorganization of CBH and Whiting Forensic Hospital. Also contemporaneous with that was the investigation done by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which they basically found that CVH was not in compliance with conditions for participation. And if you read that investigation together with the 2007 Department of Justice study, the biggest deficiency, at least with respect to the second investigation, were deficiencies in discharge planning, which speaks directly to the problem that I'm here to address, which is, what in other forums has been called the Hotel California effect for insanity acquittees. That classification of patients and the length of stay. I was going to refer to this sort of in the middle of my presentation, but I will refer to it now because you'll have the benefit of looking at this at your leisure in between now and the next time, and hopefully you might want to call me back to ask questions based on it. But I compiled and some people laugh at me because I tend to be verbose, but I tried to make this as simple as possible, a 12-page document where the first section I give a brief historical overview as to what brings us here. In the second part, I describe what it means to be not guilty by reason of insanity in the criminal system and what it means to be under the jurisdiction of the PSRB. The third section, which really is very complex, but it speaks to a lot of the problems about culture, is something that you referenced, Mr. Lawler. A brief description. Well, it includes a brief description of the different classes of patients confined at Connecticut Valley Hospital and Whiting Forensic Hospital, and the different legal standards which impact their inpatient treatment paradigms, which are very different for the civil patients in the civil division of the hospital, and patients in the Whiting Forensic part of the hospital, which are broken down into a couple of categories, as you indicated, people sent for restoration of competency, NGRI acquittees, and also DOC prisoner transfers. Yes, those are mostly high risk that are considered high risk and dangerous. Right. And those are explained in here. And then I have a specific section of what applies to patients who are insanity acquittees in terms of the legal structure there within, which is the PSRB structure. Then I have a brief summary. Then I have a general overview of the problems, potential direction for solutions, and sort of a little executive summary. But as I'm listening to all this, it's really important to understand the legal structure in which each of these patients are kept, because it speaks to the general issue of how these individuals have been treated both presently and the past by staff. Okay? And I'll sort of get into that a little bit.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry. I just want to make sure, Counselor, I'm sorry for interrupting. I just want to make sure I see reading from materials. Material that we'll be all getting copies of?
Yes.
So.
I gave the lady over there separate sets, copies of all these things for each individual, for each on the task force.
Today?
Yeah.
Maybe you were asked already, but could you also provide them in an electronic format? Is that possible? Can you email them to us so we can make them?
Oh,
Or we could scan it. Yeah.
I can do that, or if you can do that easier than me, I'm kind of a technological dinosaur.
Okay.
But I can do that.
Okay. That would be better. Thank you. Sorry to interrupt you.
No, that's okay. But anyway, it kind of brings us, me here, and the purpose is for me being here is outlined in the statute, which part of your task is to examine the role of the Psychiatric Security Review Board in all this. And that's kind of where my presentation is directed. Now, just on a broadly conceptual basis, the problems brought out by the DOJ and the more recent is that certain individuals, namely my clients under PSRB jurisdiction, are institutionalized for periods of time that far exceed acceptable standards on civil institutionalization, okay? And it, somebody else or a couple of you alluded to whether Whiting Forensic Hospital is a prison or a hospital, and that is a legitimate question. Now, in terms of the treatment modalities and philosophies, a couple of things are in common between the civil and the criminal side. Namely, one would hope that patients learn to understand on some level a relationship between their mental illness and what's needed to treat that mental illness. And also, we would hope that part of the treatment is to alert those individuals to signs that they're decompensating and that they need help and they should stay in treatment. I mean, that's common to the hospital model and the basis of the hospital model. As I understand the DEMAS philosophy, it's, the overall philosophy has, it's been referred to as the consumer model, client-centered, in those lines. The paradigm, however, that paradigm doesn't really apply on the criminal commitment side. It is more a containment model, and there are other things that are built into the treatment paradigm that are not included on the civil side. Part of the board, part of the paradigm of this system is patients have to develop insight into their crime. They have to develop remorse for their crime. And in their treatment, there is an emphasis on a lot of behaviors that fall under personality disorder realms. Such things as rule violations, how you address other persons. And obviously the board has a great deal of control over patient movement through that system, from maximum security to Dutcher, less than maximum security, to the first phase of community transition, which is in the form of staff-accompanied day treatment, et cetera, et cetera. And those steps are subject to adversary hearings. And
I don't mean to interrupt. I think I'm hearing something I've never heard before. I just want to make sure that this is the case.
Yeah.
That is for acquittees, right? If they're in Whiting, for them to be even moved to Dutcher, that's not a medical decision, that's a PSRB decision. Is that the case?
That is correct. The procedure is the board has absolute control of that decision. If the hospital determines that a person doesn't continue to need to be there, they can't just move them themselves. They have to apply to the board, and then there is an adversary proceeding.
Just to be transferred from Whiting to Dutcher.
Correct.
How about within Whiting itself? Is there any board involvement on exactly what type of room they have at Whiting, or
Whiting has its own internal level system. Dr. Caldwell could probably speak to that better than me.
My only question is, within Whiting itself, does the board have any jurisdiction to make decisions about how individuals are treated or housed?
No.
So it's only leaving the building of Whiting and moving over, let's say, to Dutcher?
Correct, which is also a locked facility.
Right, that's why I'm asking. I'm surprised to hear that.
Yeah.
The jurisdiction extends even to those decisions.
Right.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Now, that, all of that kind of brings into what goes on at the hospital kind of a different level of complexity. For instance, certain behaviors that are otherwise acceptable or overlooked or no one thinks twice about on the civil side of the hospital that are generally would be considered misbehaviors. Those things, in terms of what's reported to the board from the hospital, the hospital's required to file reports to the board every 6 months or, you know, in connection with special events. Historically, those reports have been more or less a litany of misbehaviors. Some of them can be clinical decompensation, which would be very relevant on the civil side to moving somebody forward. But it almost is weaponized in an adversary system on the board side. And it becomes problematic because things that would not be used to prevent movement to a less secure environment on the civil side are used to prevent movement to a less secure on the criminal side. And this brings in a whole host of things related to culture. Dr. Schwartz, you brought up in one of your remarks, how do we take care of our people, our staff? You know, anecdotally, it's clear that a large majority of the staff at CVH has always been and continues to be excellent at what they do and conscientious. On the other hand, there's a large number of individuals who, for one reason or another, shouldn't be in that line of work. And I think you brought that up. Also, there's another aspect to this that's a little bit more complicated than that. Historically, a large number of staff, I'm not sure what the ratio is now, have come over to CVH from the prison system, where the culture is very, very different. And for the psychologist in the
room. Can you put any dimensions on that? So when you say a large number, I mean, where are you getting that from? Are there any numbers that go along with that?
We could certainly find out.
Yeah. But
it would be an area of inquiry.
Yeah.
Because I can't tell you how many times over the years, patients have told me, or even in conversation with other, staff members, well, this person, came over from DOC, either as, and sometimes in a professional capacity, mm-hmm. and other times a line worker, that type of thing. Mm-hmm. But there's definitely a different mentality there,
yeah.
which brings up another
okay.
point, and that involves the whole issue of transference and counter-transference. If individuals' behaviors affect their movement through the PSRB system, you can easily see how if a staff member is either pissed off at a patient for personal reasons or has a mentality that this person is a criminal, they could easily weaponize it by pathologizing actions and behaviors that appear, you know, in the charts. When I have to represent these people at hearings, you know, I've learned that there's this old thing that's still very alive and well, even in 2019. You always believe the staff, you never believe the mental patient. So prior to videotape and last term asking that there be enacted a provision allowing access for counsel to videotape, there's absolutely no way to contradict anything that appears in the staff records. So that's a problem, and it has been a problem. You know, my purpose in coming here today and hopefully giving you information is to examine the role of the PSRB as it specifically relates to the function of Whiting as a hospital, and whether the board control over intra-hospital progress directly relates to, or impacts the function of the institution as a hospital as opposed to a prison, or how it, you know, perpetuates, you know, the dynamics that led to the, you know, abuse. The other material that I've given you is an article that was published in 2016. It was a research study about the impact of the board, of board jurisdiction, on acuity recidivism. And it's the latest statistical information comparing recidivism of acuities to recidivism of other criminal justice populations that have mental illness or serious mental illness. The one conclusion that it comes to is a period of outpatient supervision under the PSRB is an extremely protective factor. So I'm not here to trash the PSRB in any way, shape, or form. What it says is an open question is and really needs to be seriously looked at is the extended inpatient portion of an acuity's commitment. Is that, number one, necessary? Certainly isn't cost efficient, because what you end up having is, you know, a group of individuals who would not even, you know, set foot on the inside of a mental institution if they were on the civil side. And as you can probably imagine, you know, the complexity of the interaction between the legal system, the transference, counter-transference thing, background experience leaves patients, staff who don't have experience on both sides of the equation, even professionals on both sides, the criminal and civil commitment side of the equation, saying, you know, what are these same people doing in the same institution for varying lengths of time? It creates utter confusion on a lot of different levels. including public confusion, and that's another issue which I won't, you know, get into right now, but which I could.
Did you say that the patients who are acquittees and are confined at Whiting, were they not forensic patients? Were they just regular people receiving appropriate mental health care, would not be in a locked or inpatient facility? Is that what you're saying? Like, they don't put aside the criminal justice system's involvement. They don't need to be in a hospital? Is that what you're saying? Some of them?
Well, I don't know that you want to go that far because...
What did you mean by what you said there? You said that there were people who were in under the PSRB who would never be subject to such treatment
if they had not committed a crime that carried with it a fairly lengthy prison term. A lot of these individuals were sufficiently stabilized between the time of the crime and the time of, the verdict and commitment, which is oftentimes could be a year or 2 years later, would not be the type of individual who would be probated into an inpatient mental institution.
Right.
And that's not always the case.
Right. You're saying there's some instance of that in your opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Nice. So why don't we let Kevin Muller weigh in on this?
Sure.
Then we can have questions. Is that all right?
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, and thank you for allowing me the opportunity to present to you guys today. Again, my name is Kevin Lawler. I am currently the Deputy Chief of the Division of Criminal Justice. I work on the operations side prior to working at the Chief State's Attorney's Office. I was a State's Attorney in the Ansonia Milford Judicial District for 12 years, and for about 12 years prior to that, I was an Assistant State's Attorney in that particular district as well. Over the course of that period of my career, I tried numerous cases to verdict, many of which were the cases that we're kind of talking about here today, people who, for lack of a better term, were found guilty or not guilty by reason of insanity and sentenced to a term of supervision at the hospital. I've also, the other area that Michael has indicated you guys are interested in, as far as the NGRI, I mean the 5456D or competency process, I've also been involved in numerous hearings along those lines and can provide you with some answers as far as, you know, the field level decision making process or how those cases actually are handled as well. My experience here that I'd like to share with you is, you know, primarily as a representative of the state, of the Division of Criminal Justice before the PSRB, representing the state during these types of trials, and also our interaction with Whiting and with CVH. I think there's really three primary areas where we have involvement. The first is in kind of the investigatory, the prosecutorial, and the trial phase of any particular case. I'm sure as many of you are aware, usually cases that involve defendants where they end up at Whiting out with a charge of NGR or with a finding of not guilty by reason of insanity, those cases, as Monty points out, are primarily the most serious cases we face. In preparation for today, I pulled all the cases out of my former judicial district where there was a finding. And basically, so you understand, you know, the charges that we're talking about that put people under the supervision of the board, there were 13 cases coming out of my judicial district during my time there, and findings of mental disease or defect were for the charges of murder, assault in the first degree, robbery in the first degree, sexual assault in the first degree, arson in the second degree, murder, attempted murder, assault in the first degree, murder, and manufacture of bombs. So those are the charges that most people are facing when they enter this arena. I think another thing that's important to understand is that there's no way to be found not guilty by mental disease or defect unless you affirmatively ask for that from either a jury or a judge. These matters where this is brought forward, this is an affirmative defense raised by the defense, basically asking for this level of supervision. In order to prevail, the state first has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the crime was committed. So everyone under the jurisdiction of the board has been found beyond a reasonable doubt to have committed these crimes. They are then, there's an affirmative defense that is filed, and the defense has to make, by a preponderance of, the evidence, have the, either the jury or the judge or a three-judge panel, if it's a murder case, they have to make a finding that the defendant lacked substantial capacity to understand the wrongfulness of his conduct or to control his conduct within the confines of the law. So they've all had a trial that has been either contested where the state disagrees with that, or in many cases the state actually agrees that, in fact, this person does suffer from a serious mental illness, where we also agree that it's the most appropriate finding is a finding of not guilty due to mental disease or defect. Really, how that normally happens is the defense will, as an initial step, have the defendant review evaluated by a mental health expert. They will present both the court and the state with a report from that expert where they're making a medical evaluation that a jury could consider under that standard that I just outlined. Many times the state and the law provides for the state to be able to request their own expert to interview the defendant and review all of those medical records in an attempt to form an alternative medical opinion under that legal standard. Many times our expert comes back and says, we agree. And in those kinds of cases, we still have a trial where we prove either to the court or to a jury that the crime did in fact occur beyond a reasonable doubt, and then both medical experts' testimony is provided to the court. Once that has occurred, either in the contested or the uncontested avenue, there has to be a verdict of either guilty and the affirmative defense has not been reached, or the affirmative defense is found and the person is found not guilty by mental disease or defect. Once that occurs, if it does occur, then the person is referred to the jurisdiction of the PSRB. They go to Whiting, and they have further evaluations done. At that point, the case is returned with a report to the presiding judge who heard the trial. And then the person who has been found not guilty by mental disease or defect at a hearing is then referred to the board for a term. The term cannot exceed the maximum punishment you could have gotten had you been sentenced to prison. So in the case of a murder defendant, where the maximum sentence is life in prison, in Connecticut that's defined as 60 years, you could be sentenced to a term under the board of up to 60 years. For the other cases that I mentioned, most of those are B felonies, where the longest period of commitment will be 20 years. Judges frequently do not give just the – they just don't hand out the maximum term of commitment. They review the board's recommendations. They listen to the recommendations of counsel for the defense, the state's attorney, the victim, and then they make a decision within that range of terms of commitment. Person is then referred back to the board, and then as Monty has pointed out, we have these six-month mandatory review of status hearings. One of the roles that the state plays in this, again, is you know, and I'll come back to it several times, is, you know, as it is an adversary proceeding, but it's not a judicial proceeding. You know, it's heard before the board. There are no real rules of evidence or anything along those lines, but we are both there. And I think one of my main jobs, along with you know, assuring that the and questioning the treatment providers as to what they're doing to assure public safety, is also to be able to inform victims and victims' families of this process. Most victims' families have really no idea what the PSRB process means. Most feel that it's just like, has been pointed out here, a lot of people perceive it as just kind of like jail for people who have mental health problems. And I have to be able to explain to people that that's not, in fact, what's going on here. That what is going on here is the goal is to make people better, to try and help them. And if they do get better, then they can get out into the community. So that's often very hard for victims to understand, is that even in a, we can't even assure that 2 years from now this person will be in a facility. They could be on the street. And it's up to us to be able to explain the PSRB process and the various steps that Monty has pointed out that have to be to go through before someone can obtain their freedom from underneath the jurisdiction of the board. So when the case does arrive at the PSRB, and we do have these periodic status hearings before the board, the state's attorney's role really is to assure, on the one hand, through questioning of the treatment providers at the hospital, that the reports accurately reflect the progress of the acquittee. Now, on the state's attorney's side, I can only speak for myself, but I believe for most other state's attorney's offices, we have a system normally where the prosecutor who handled the trial and the prosecution going through, because we get so intimately involved in the background of these defendants, they maintain the case once it goes to PSRB. There are several jurisdictions where maybe one or two prosecutors develop this as a specialty. I know in Hartford you have Vicky Melchiori for in my office. Basically, it was me when I was in Milford. But we do, as Monty has pointed out, we try to maintain some level of longitudinal review of these cases because we are so intimately familiar with it. So we are there to make sure that the progress that's indicated on the report is accurate. So, you know, it's not. I wouldn't suggest that it's confrontational. I think mostly, you know, like any other written document, as lawyers, we can have alternative interpretations of what's included in the report. And for us to assure public safety for individuals who have been found to have been committed. You know, the most serious crimes out there, that we want to assure public safety is maintained. You know, I think that that's one of the things, you know, where Monty and I have had disagreements over the years is, you know, we do talk about, and Monty and I have had these discussions many times before, where we talk about, you know, he indicates that on the civil side these people wouldn't be committed. Well, maybe that's true, but these people are not on the civil side. These people have been found beyond a reasonable doubt to have committed some of the most heinous crimes on the books. And so I think that just from that perspective, we have to be more careful, because we have had findings that their mental illness played a part in them committing those crimes. Not that it's their fault, they have an illness that needs to be treated, but the fact remains that these individuals have violated some of our state's most serious statutes. So we do that as they move through the process. One of the things that can happen, as was pointed out by Monty, is there are these various transitions from Whiting to Dutcher, from Dutcher to temporary leave, which is you're still a patient of the hospital, but you are allowed in the community, where you have community events where you're allowed to just leave the hospital if you're in Dutcher. And I think that's one of the reasons, to your point, Michael, about you know, the board's ability to control whether you leave Whiting or you go just to Dutcher, is because once you're in Dutcher, there is ability to leave the grounds and be in a group setting, supervised but also work related where you're on your own, recognizance a lot of the time.
So can I just ask on that for the patients who are who've made it to Dutcher, who are under PSRB jurisdiction, for each of those things you're describing, is there does there need to be a discrete, explicit permission from the PSRB for those to happen, or does that just go with your being at Dutcher?
I think that just my understanding is that those are within the parameters at Dutcher, and normally what the
Monty's disagreeing. So.
They will put out what the parameters will be once the person gets to Dutcher, and then they have to live within those parameters that are agreed to by the PSRB. So I don't know if it's automatic if that's what you're
right
saying.
There. What's do you mind? Do you mind if we just ask Ellen to clarify this issue?
Please.
Yeah.
Can I also?
I think Lori has clarification.
Yeah. Okay.
Just with regard to the internal process at Dutcher. So once somebody is at Dutcher, a PSRB patient or anybody at Dutcher, there are certain level systems that they have to work through, from being escorted at all times versus being allowed to go down to the treatment mall and the fitness center and things like that within the building, either with staff or without staff, and then they can be on grounds with staff, without staff, have certain pastimes. So those levels that they work through, and those are an internal process of the hospital that's governed by their forensic review committee. Once you get to where somebody is going to, a PSRB acquittee is going to go on temporary leaves, and Ellen, you may be able to speak more to this, then that is a board decision that they have to approve them to go into the community for treatment and be left there for a period of time while they're receiving treatment at that setting, and then be brought back to the hospital.
So if I'm understanding this correctly, because this is important to our deliberation, yeah. So I just want to make sure I have it clearly, that when you get to Dutcher, which is in fact a locked facility, right, there are certain sort of gradients of supervision or liberty that you have while you're at Dutcher, right? But there are some of those, like, for example, being able to leave the building, which are subject to the approval of the PSRB, or at least subject to restrictions previously imposed by the PSRB. Like, at what point does the PSRB have to be notified or consulted or agree to freedoms once you're at Dutcher? I guess that's like, how do you draw the line? Right. Well, Ellen is here. Why don't you?
So the distinction is that when someone's at Dutcher, the board has no involvement in terms of their privilege level and if they leave the hospital with staff. Only when they leave the hospital without staff do they require an intervention and approval by the board, and that's called temporary leave.
Okay, and so, in other words, okay, go on.
Because there are different levels of temporary leave.
A lot of those initially are staff accompanied. It's not somebody just goes out.
Right.
Yeah, so.
So, but I guess my question is, what's the difference between being at Whiting and at Dutcher in terms of your ability to do something without the approval of the PSRB? So, like, I take it that if you're at Whiting, there's no furloughs or anything like that, right? That's only a possibility once you get to Dutcher, or am I wrong in that?
But you're correct. When you're at Whiting Forensic Hospital, the maximum security portion, there is no community involvement in the community without staff. I mean, staff may take a patient for medical care, that kind of thing. We don't get involved with that. Similarly, we don't get involved if staff at Dutcher take a patient off grounds to a library, to a rehab trip. We don't get involved with that. That's part of the privilege level system that's solely at the discretion of the hospital.
Okay.
Only when a patient leaves the grounds of the hospital, usually through the Dutcher system, at that point, without staff or where they would be in the community with limited staff supervision, as Monty had talked about, there's varying degrees, but without burdening you with that information. It's the case where the individual requires permission from the board so that they're not supervised.
So, because the reason I'm asking these questions,
staff.
I just want to understand why, what's the policy reason behind PSRB approving the move from Whiting to Dutcher? So it does sound as though once you get to Dutcher, the odds that you are going to be able to do something which is a little bit more, you'll have a little bit more liberty, or at least potentially have more liberty, Then that justifies the PSRB decision on the move.
That's correct. I'm guessing that that's correct in 1985 when the legislature created that, but Kevin is correct about that, that there are privilege levels that the board does not control when a patient leaves Whiting to Dutcher, and that privilege level can be from zero, where they have no privileges, to being on grounds by themselves without supervision or going off grounds with staff to different variety of activities.
Just as a point of information, all of these levels are subject to fairly heavy clinical scrutiny by the hospital's internal, what they call the Forensic Review Committee. There are level meetings every week. There's all kinds of input. And so it's not just a willy-nilly procedure. Okay.
I guess we're looking for the things that are unique to the forensic patients,
yeah.
Right?
Right.
And the role of the PSRB is still, to this day, somewhat unclear to me. And you know, I mean, you guys know way more than I do. But it's it. But thank you. I got it.
Mike, for the record, could our last speaker just identify her for the record and for me? And
I think Ellen has appeared at one of our earlier meetings.
Yes, in May. We may not have met. So I'm Ellen LaChance, Executive Director of the Psychiatric Security Review Board.
Thank you.
So getting back to, once we have gone through that process and people have, if they go according to what everyone envisions, they have more and more privileges, and the state is there basically just to, in our minds, make sure that those steps are appropriate and point out where we believe there may be deficiencies in the reports. If a person needs to possibly be recommitted, the state plays a role in that as well.
Could you explain what recommitted means?
Yeah, recommitment is, as I indicated earlier, a judge at the initial, after a person has been found not guilty by mental disease or defect, refers them under to the custody of the board for a period of time. And as I said, it could be up to 60 years for murder, up to 20 years for a B felony. And when their term expires, that would mean that they would be removed from the jurisdiction of the board. They could just walk out the door without any supervision. Under our law, it allows for the state's attorney towards the end of their term of commitment to apply to the court, the sentencing court, to have that individual recommitted if we meet certain statutory requirements.
Can that only be done before the expiration of the
Correct.
Original term?
Normally, the board will indicate to us and remind us that a person is due, their term may be expiring. Usually it's about 18 months out. And then we will decide what we're going to do in that particular case.
Does the board have the authority to sort of commute the term? Or
yes, you can be released early, and people
so
have.
So they could end their.
It's not the board, the court.
Yes, the court can
do it, not
but
the board on its own.
But the board can recommend, makes recommend. You know, the court asks for the input from the board. As to whether or not someone should their term should be ended early. So there is a possibility of getting out early, and it has happened.
So to me, in my head, I'm making the analogy to like the role the Board of Pardons and Paroles plays in the criminal side and stuff like that. So is it the case that the board from time to time might decide that this individual does not require additional supervision and on its own, rather than being invited by the court, on its own recommends to the court that the termination should be ended?
Yes. Yes, and that has happened. In my judicial district, during my time, I think, as I indicated, we had 13 individuals who were sentenced to the custody of PSRB. One was discharged by the court. I allowed the term of commitment to expire because there was an appropriate plan in place for that individual, and he had shown an extended period of time where he could be managed in the community in a safe manner, that we did not believe that recommitment was appropriate. Two people were deceased, and I believe now we have 9 that are active under board supervision at this time.
So
If the original maximum period of time for which you can be committed to the board is whatever is the maximum available criminal penalty, let's just say a judge committed a person for the maximum, let's say in one of these, in a B felony, 20 years, right? So could the court actually extend that beyond the 20 years?
Yes. That is a possibility. But as I've indicated before, it's not like something where every judge just gives you the max. They're frequent. It's much, I think, more common for you to get something less than that. Usually it's like 5 or 10 years under the jurisdiction of the board, and then we see, that extended upwards further on down the line. I think that's more in line with, like, people who are guilty or are found not guilty by mental disease or defect for things other than murder.
Right.
For the murders, those tend to have longer periods of supervision attached to them.
Is it ever the case that people transition from PSRB jurisdiction, like it expires, for example, and they just seek a civil commitment from that point forward? I mean, isn't that always like an option that's available? I'm just curious, right?
I guess it's an option. It's not in my experience that we've ever done that. Once we have brought that motion forward, again, this is not recommitment is not a decision that's made by the state's attorney or made by the PSRB. It's a decision that's made in court by the presiding judge of that district, or in some cases, if the judge is still around, some districts refer it back to the original judge. Once you are those that are recommitted, the individuals, I think one of the things that Monty has, pointed out is, and I think it, for some people it holds true that some that are recommitted certainly have antisocial character traits, antisocial issues. They certainly have other factors such as long records, sex offenders, documented issues with not just following the minor rules. I mean, Monty and I have had individuals who, the focus has been on things like they sneak cigarettes on the campus. But, the things that in my experience have been persuasive to the court in the recommitment setting are those types of rule-breaking behaviors that directly correlate to issues that they had that led them to commit their underlying offenses. Things that might seem innocuous on their face, things like compulsive gambling or running up lots of credit card debt, compulsive buying on the internet or difficulty in relationships with members of the opposite sex. Those kinds of things that perhaps in a civil setting may not seem significant, but if you basically were found guilty of murdering someone because you had a deep compensation because you had $100,000 in credit card debt and you couldn't stop your pathological gambling and those kinds of things led to the stress that caused you to commit that crime, those are things that are indicative of the behavior that led to the commission of your qualifying offense. So I think that those are some of the things that can be seen as quote-unquote rule-breaking behavior but have an impact particularly on the court when we seek recommitment.
So can I just point out, we have about 20 minutes left, and I have a class to teach at 4:30, just to be clear.
I just have a couple of quick stats
but,
that I'd like to be able
because
to
because I want to get to – I'm sure there may be some follow-up questions as well. So.
Yeah. So and lastly, these are some of the things that, when we try and explain the expectations to victims of crime, some of the things that we point out, and I had these stats updated, but I usually use them when I talk to people. I believe in PSRB, and I'm not sure how far back we go on these, but like 72 individuals have been released early. 100 individuals have been recommitted. So it's not an issue where there's only one or two of one and more of the other. I think also it's important to understand that most people do progress through the system to some degree. Of the individuals at maximum security Whiting, of the 103 individuals who've gone through there, I can't remember the time frame we were using, but 103 have progressed out of maximum security, and 8 remain. The acquittees who've been approved for temporary leave, those who've applied, the most recent stats that I got is 286 were granted temporary leave, 21 were denied. And for community release, the most liberal form of supervision where you're actually in the community, 91 were granted community release and 4 were denied.
And so you don't know the time frame we're talking about?
I can't remember. I can ask.
2007 to November 9th, 2019.
Okay, so in the last 12 years, basically 12 years. Since I've been state's attorney. Yeah,
okay.
Or when I was the state's attorney. So I mean, those are the things that we have to explain to victims that show that people are going to progress through the system no matter, you know, kind of what their crime is, except in rare circumstances.
So maybe are there questions for either two folks?
I would just comment. We had a fairly good primer early in our, and you neither one of you were able to hear it, and we also have all visited the facilities. That helped us understand the levels and tiers. So just our lack of questions is not a lack of caring about your testimony.
I'm fine with it, really.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Fairly good. I did want to clarify one thing, if I could, Mr. Chairman. Attorney Radler just made a couple of comments. I just want to make sure I heard you properly. One was a reference to something that Madam Chairman said about the staff in a stressful environment needing ongoing, what I interpret you to say was ongoing support. I didn't hear you say what I thought Attorney Radler said, that people, admittedly it's probably true, that people shouldn't be in that job. I don't think you said that.
I didn't say that, but it does take very special people to be in that situation. And the best way is to support them through training and education and the support. So I did not say that, but I strongly believe that when you're in a situation where you don't know what's going to happen and you're surrounded, you have to be comfortable. You have to have some sense of confidence in yourself and that you will be able to deal with this. Because I have said this before, and I don't mind saying it again, because sometimes some of the behavior that we saw in the culture was that the staff was far more afraid of the patient, and they wanted to make the patient afraid of them.
Understood. You've been clear on that. I had one more comment or question, I guess, for Attorney Radler. The other thing is, and maybe it's not for you, maybe it's for us, again, understanding our purview. There were comments made about duration of term or whether people would be in a committed psychiatric hospital if they hadn't committed the crime. So Justin Schechter used to work with me at Stanford. So, you know, he did say you were like an intern. So I just want to make sure and I don't want to question your qualifications, but I don't think that's our purview, right, to question either the process of psychiatric review board or whether people would be there or not be there. Or is that beyond our? I mean, my sense is that's not our.
I think the exact quote from the scope here.
You know, it is.
Examine the role of the PSR.
Yeah, I think it was one of our early ones.
And I think it's worth noting over the years. I mean, the reason I know Mati is because as both a legislator and Governor Molloy, we had many discussions about tweaks in the scope of PSRB, and there's been numerous legislative proposals to do that. And it's a very interesting and complicated and fascinating discussion, but I think it's been asserted over the years that Connecticut's system is somewhat unique, which I think it is, and is considered to be relatively what's the right word? Restrictive? I don't know.
Pejorative.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's a pretty strict system compared to what exists in other states.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't mean it's good or bad. It just means it is an outlier, and people, for some, you know, raise questions about should we reconsider the whole thing. So
30 years ago, I might have had it in place, modeling itself after other states. But
right.
Now,
yeah, I mean, there's so much advance in the general field of not only treatment but risk assessment. It's a different universe.
Thank you.
Yeah. Paul.
thank you both. I was interested in Mike's questioning around the transfer from Whiting to Dutcher. This is just based on that the person's doing better, or have political reasons influenced someone not moving, or their application being withdrawn, or...
A lot of the problem arises because of the statute related to describes who should be in Whiting, and it's described as so violent as to require maximum security setting. You have number of acquittees who are in Whiting who are clinically stable, have not been assaultive or violent, and they're not allowed out of Whiting. And this sort of brings up another area that I didn't get to that you should be aware of. I think you're all familiar with the Patient's Bill of Rights.
Yeah.
That's applicable to patients and certain rights, that civil rights that people have with respect to refusal or acceptance of certain forms of psychiatric treatment. There's kind of a very peculiar disconnect when it comes to insanity acquittees and whether they have or don't have those civil rights. For instance, in order to move through the PSRB system within the hospital, medication compliance is not an issue. You have to take those meds or you don't go forward. If another area is self-expression, self-advocacy. There are a lot of patients, or especially some of the smarter ones, who say, well, patients are supposed to have these rights. What about me? And there are certain elements of the culture there that regards them as being either litigious or paranoid or some other pathologic connections to it. And in the way that those behaviors are transmitted documentarily to the board, those are often grounds for the board not, if those behaviors are characterized as pathological, then those people are not allowed to move forward. So that creates an additional layer of confusion both for patients and staff. It's kind of two different universes within a hospital.
I think in reading some of those issues, I saw that someone failed to sign out of one room when they were moving to another room, and that was counted as a failure to follow the rules. And you're right, it can be placed in a report that would be make it sound like they were very difficult to do anything with.
And that speaks to the culture issue, and I mentioned, certain behaviors being weaponized. I've heard anecdotally over the years that staff members who have something against a patient for a variety of different reasons. It could be that the patient is just, in a difficult environment, will put things in the record. And if the client says otherwise, the client is not believed because there's no evidence other than the client's word. So those kind of things get into the person's record, follow that person. And, I've heard psychiatrists or psychologists at treatment team meetings, say any number of times, sometimes relevant, sometimes not, well, the board's going to expect you to do this, the board's going to expect you to do that. I mean, Ellen would say, well, that's not right, we don't. And yet, That's what the hospital says. I think a lot of these things will be explained in that information sheet that I...
I have to say, though, in my experience at the board, the minor infractions that you're talking about in seclusion, I've never heard that as being like an aha, gotcha, you're not going to be able to move because you have this blemish. That's not, you know, in my experience, it's been because it's a six-month look, and you look at what they've done through an entire period of time. And that may be one small part of a much larger picture that's being painted at the six-month review. And for every time that something like that's happened, you know, I've cross-examined the members of the hospital for what I believed being too lenient in their reports, where there have been people where, you know, they just say, well, he made some progress. He's making progress. And then I say, well, what does progress mean? Can you illustrate what is different today in Mr. X's behavior that was different from when you said he's making incremental progress 6 months ago? And they really don't have much to say. So I think that's why it's an adversarial process in that regard, is that both sides can interpret these things. And at the end of the day, it's up to the board under their statutory authority and, you know, to weigh public safety and the benefit of mental health of the patient to make those decisions. So, I mean, I think it does go both ways is all I can say in that regard.
Just two more questions for both the attorneys. Are people moving through the PSRB system faster, like was asserted earlier?
What I can say is that, at least with respect to the temporary leave stages, things have accelerated over the last year, but there's been a lot of coordinated effort, to speed up the bureaucratic process, to eliminate bureaucratic hurdles, and that's another problem.
Okay. Yeah. And again, for both attorneys, so as we're looking at the PSRB, do you think it's minor tweaks, a major overhaul, or just get rid of it? What do you recommend?
In my experience, I think they're a highly professional, very dedicated group looking to do, they're two counterbalance charges of assuring the mental health of and progress of these individuals who have committed extremely serious crimes, on the one hand, and public safety for those people in the community. On the other hand, I believe that they're doing a good job of that. And if you can find minor areas of improvement, I mean, we can always improve. We can always do better. I think that's the charge of this group is to listen to all of these different viewpoints and come up with what you think are the best practices. But I don't believe it needs a major overhaul.
If I could answer, I think this task force has to look very closely at how the legal system of the board interacts with the hospital's internal process and what is necessary, what is not necessary to return the forensic part of the hospital to more of a hospital function than just a custodial function.
Nancy?
Yeah, so getting back to this, digging a little deeper, how much, well, obviously, Mr. Lowell, you don't think there are a lot of problems with it. I think Monty has a different perspective. But you're, as you talk about trying to balance public safety versus patients' rights, how much of the difficulty is because the PSRB is making what are essentially clinical decisions, but they're not clinicians? Do you see that as something that requires overhaul for both of you?
I think it's something that needs to be closely looked at, because you have basically a mental hospital with two different classes of patients being kept in a mental hospital for two relatively different functions that uses the same verbiage for the legal standard and basically, you know, affects people's rights. Also, under one, you know, under one system, the state doesn't get reimbursed, you know, federally reimbursed, you know, for hospital expenses, and under the other, it does. I mean, plus, that kind of internal control outside of a purely clinical level leads to abusive situations.
Are you suggesting? I'm sorry. Are you suggesting that there are some secondary gain issues related to the duration of stay of the patients at Whiting Forensic? I just want to make sure that payment. You know, I live in a world with a lot of different payment models, so I just want to make sure I understood your comment about that. Could you just clarify what you meant?
Secondary gain.
Just clarify your comment then about the payment.
You were talking about reimbursement,
scheme, depending on
reimbursement for the care.
Yeah.
Can you say more?
Federal reimbursement to the extent that, I mean, under federal law for institutionalized persons and reimbursement, you know, they have to meet a standard of moving a patient along in accordance with clinical needs balanced with you know, civil rights, so to speak. And the PSRB, in terms of time limits and everything else, is really more of a public safety, protecting public safety model than clinical necessity for, you know, a mental condition. You know, we actually, over the last 20 years in the public defender system, we don't advocate anybody with a minor, relatively minor offense and use the insanity defense because of the length of time they'll be hospitalized and institutionalized. Now, the unfortunate reality of that is that people who could have asserted it plea bargain a jail sentence, they're in corrections for that period of time. When their sentence is up, they walk out the door without the benefit of years of treatment and the outpatient supervision that the board actually provides. And you know, nobody can do anything. So what sense does that make?
I'm going to call our attention to the fact that Nancy was probably right, that we are running out of time. I am wondering if the task force would consider or want to consider inviting these gentlemen back. And if so, I would entertain a motion that we do that. And we would look forward to continuing this discussion. So it has been moved. Has it been seconded? Yeah, we will. We will. It moved and seconded that we invite our Mr. Lawler and Mr. Radler back to continue this discussion. Yes, together.
Yeah.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. We will work with you on your schedules. Is there any more business to come before us today? I just want to say we were, the discussion was supposed to be about the Dutcher Patient Steering Committee visit. Did everybody receive the readout on the email about our, no, people did not?
The legislator sent it to both the chairs, you and Mike.
Say again?
It was sent to Mike and yourself.
All right. Very briefly remind everyone that on the 13th of Friday the 13th, we will be meeting at Dutcher. We have been advised by the legislative office, counseling office, about how we can actually convene a meeting and then go to, this is the agenda, let me just say it to you, that we convene our meeting at 1, as we discussed, that we can have whatever needs to be transpired by the whatever business comes before us, and then we can entertain a motion to go into executive session. All right, that was how we were advised to proceed, and I think we are going to do that. So I want to say happy Thanksgiving to everyone, and thank you all for the wonderful discussion that we've had today. Thank you so much.